Welcome to Betting 360, your number one source for horse racing and sports betting insights. Coming around the bend is your host, David Duffield, with another expert interview to give you the winning edge.
Hi, this is Dave Duffield, and welcome to another episode of the Betting 360 podcast. I've got Nick Pinkerton back on the show this week. We first had him on around about 18 months ago, so I wanted to touch base with him and see how he's been going in the meantime. And to do that, we've taken questions from our members just to see what it is they'd like to ask of a professional punter. So that's fallen into probably four broad categories, being getting started in terms of confidence, skills and a plan, lifestyle, you know, the mindset, discipline and work-life balance. And then we've got form analysis, in terms of how to find an edge and how to do the form, and then finally bet placement these days when it's not easy to get a bet on, but also staking and money management and the way he approaches that. So let's talk with Nick. G'day Nick, and welcome back to the show.
Hi David, how are you?
Yeah, going really well, thanks. Looking forward to having another chat with you. We had you on around about 18 months ago and had followed you up until that time as well. So, yeah, just wanted to check in with you, see how things have been going. And also, we've taken some questions from our members on some of their most pressing issues and also what they would like to ask of someone that's been in this game for quite a while. So we'll run through those in just a moment, if that's okay.
Yep, no problems at all.
All right, the first, I suppose, range of topics that came up was just to do with getting started. And one of the common questions was how you gain the confidence when you're starting out.
Yeah, look, I think in regards to confidence, I see punting as a bit of an extreme sport. So if you use skiing as an analogy, lots of people can enjoy green runs and have fun. You know, some can go down a green run and tumble, and others don't like to tumble. And yet there's plenty of people who, with a bit of practice, can go and tackle a black diamond run. But it takes a completely different type of attitude and application, you know, to get to representative level or whatever it is you're doing. And betting is all about confidence, you know, and if you've got skills and a plan, you'll get there. But nothing builds confidence more than having that intimate knowledge of what factors provide you with the edge that you've got and helping you make that money. So the most important thing is just trying to identify what your edge is. I'm not all things to all punters, but you know, I managed to find out what works for me, although it hasn't always been that way. Since we last spoke, I've actually just got back from a long break from racing. Only in September of this year did I come back from Caulfield Cup Day of 2013. And one of the reasons I took that break from racing was I actually had a dent to my own confidence. So we're not immune to it, even after 20 years of successful punting. I had my first extended losing period in sort of the middle of 2013 through to Caulfield Cup Day, and at the time it seemed inexplicable. But funnily enough, when I stepped away, as most things do, when you get out of the heat, you can see the trees for the forest, and I realised a few things. Basically, I got away from the things I used to do and do well, and I got confused between what my strengths were, and I tried to incorporate a lot of things that were just not my natural way of doing things, and I got more further and further away from the things I was confident about, even to the point that I started to question whether I even had an edge in the things that I thought I did.
So we might expand on that a little bit later. Just interesting to see the journey that you've been on. But in terms of, you know, getting started, we've got a lot of guys that would dream about, you know, going from what they're doing right now to doing it full time. Obviously, the skills and a plan is one part of it. You think it's the only way to have that confidence is just to have that, you know, those skills and that background behind you?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the sayings I grew up with when I was a financial markets trader through the 80s and 90s is I once came across a saying, and it says, fear is crippling and fear comes from ignorance. Now, that's not ignorance in an absolute sense, obviously, but it's ignorance in the sense that you can be overwhelmed or intimidated by what you don't know. And I think that's the most important thing, you know, for a punter to go from a weekend warrior or a part-time punter with a full-time job to someone who relies on it for an income, you really need to understand what it is that you don't know you don't know. So you've got to read and research everything you possibly can, because most of us know what we don't know, but a lot of us don't know what we don't know, and that's the thing. So you've got to look at other successful punters around you, find out what they're doing, and find out what resonates best with you and build a plan around that.
I like that quote about fear. Another one I'd heard, which isn't probably quite as appropriate, but fear is pissing your pants. And courage is being able to get on with the job with wet pants.
Absolutely, yeah. And, courage and resilience is something that a professional punter definitely needs a lot of. Yeah.
Now, another one about getting started was, what is it regarded as an acceptable strike rate? And this is the way it was phrased to us, so he may even mention profitability, but what is regarded as an acceptable strike rate for a serious punter to aim for, or is there another measure that should guide a punter?
Yeah, I wouldn't be concerned about strike rate at all. You know, I'd be hard pressed at any period of, I mean, I could get the figures, of course, but over 20 years, I've never had a look at what my strike rate is. If I'm reporting on results, yes, I'll say I had a strike rate of an average dividends of, but I've got to go and find it. It's not something I'm looking at. I think what's far more important is profitability. You need to be looking at what your level of profitability is, or your profit on turnover is. And again, I come back to it, you need to be mindful of where that's coming from. Where is your edge? You know, I've met a lot of fantastic pre-race analysts, but they're not great at post-race analysis. I've met lots of great pre- and post-race analysis, but they're just no good with race day betting operations. They just don't know how to bet. You know, they can isolate winners and they can frame a good market, but they take the market to the races and they come home losing. I think you're just what it is that's giving you the value that you think you've got in the marketplace. That's the most important thing. Not strike rate, but your profit on turnover and your profitability will give you an answer to what that edge is, and you should know through what you're doing where that edge is coming from.
Yeah, and the one time, or one of the main things you do want to be aware of your strike rate, I know you said it's not a major metric you look at in terms of success, but just bankroll management and, you know, being able to cope with losing runs, that's obviously the lower the strike rate, the longer the losing runs you're going to have, and you need both the bankroll and the mindset to overcome that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there that the key to bankrolls and strike, or the key to bankrolls is having a realistic expectation of what your horse's chances are of actually winning a race. I think on balance, the average punter watches a $4 chance go around in a race, and I think their expectation is the horse has a much better chance than the average $4 chance would have. And likewise, I know people who back odds on chances, and they just think they're across the line. You know, you're taking $1.80 something, you think it's a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. But the reality is $1.80 chance is going to get beaten plenty of times. So you can't kick the can when two or three of them get beaten. You happen to bet four or five of them in a row and they fall over. You know, it's certainly not beyond the realms of possibility. So I think you have to keep in mind the whole time what a horse's most realistic chance of winning is. And obviously starting price is the best guide to that. And if you're going to back $10 chances, you need to manage your business a hell of a lot differently than if you're going to back even money chances.
Another question we had, and you've mentioned this in terms of knowing your edge and also confidence and discipline, but it says, what, in your opinion, is the biggest key to long-term success?
Very good question. I think it's having a very clear plan that's built around your skills and the skills that work for you, and then the discipline and resilience to carry that out. And when I mean resilience, I'm talking about the ability to have the next bet exactly the same as you would have before the previous bet's been resulted.
That's a good way of looking at it. And one of the things I've noticed, just speaking to a whole gamut of professionals across different codes, is that everyone operates differently, so that you can't just, you know, buy a professional punting franchise and operate it that way. People have very different approaches and they can all win with different strategies and definitely different mindsets.
Absolutely. I think the art of a professional punter, or the success of a successful punter, actually combines art and science. I think to be a successful punter, you need to be an artist with a science degree, basically. The science degree will keep you solid and in line with facts and statistics, and the artistic element will obviously allow you to bring in your own interpretation of variables. For argument's sake, with me, I would say my number one strength is in my pre-race analysis, which comes from my post-race work. I do a hell of a lot of video replay work, and I look for a certain profile of horse. I look for a horse that basically can demonstrate a capacity to absorb pressure in a race and still finish its race off. So it's it's a combination of sections and just overcoming some sort of sectionals and overcoming some sort of adversity. But you know, that involves some sort of artistic nature. I've tried to teach that to people to get some duplicatability or duplication in the amount of work I can cover, but I've had varying degrees of success, you know, with doing that. Some people get it, some people don't. I try and map it down to a set of markers, and I think that would make it easy by making it a science. But a classic, try and teach someone when a horse is pulling. You know, we can all see the extreme examples, but it takes a lot of experience and a lot of practice to know when it is really pulling to the detriment of itself, or when it's just racing a little bit keen and it's probably not going to make a lot of difference to the outcome. It's just not something I find you can teach.
So that covers some of the getting started questions that we had. There were three other, I suppose, broad categories that came through. The next one would be lifestyle and mindset issues, then form analysis, and then, you know, bet placement, money management, that type of thing. So, yeah, and the next category being lifestyle and mindset. A question we had was, my biggest pain is me. In your punting life, have you ever felt this way? It's such an up-and-down business, and could you share some strategies on some ordinary periods? You mentioned that post Caulfield Cup Day 2013 was one of those periods, or the lead up to that anyway. What would you share with someone like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. The roller coaster nature of punting is just something we've got to get used to. I don't think there's too many ways around it, and the nature of the beast is you're just going to have those ebbs and flows. What I think is really important is that resilience I talked about before. There was a study done back in 2005, and it's an interesting study. They found a group of American academics, and some of them had an injury. They had a known injury to areas of their brain that were known to be associated with emotions. So they had 20 of those people, and they had 20 people that were supposedly uninjured. They each gave them $20, and they gave them 6-4 about a coin toss. And they were going to toss the coin 20 times, and they each had an opportunity to have a $1 wager on each of those 20 tosses. And the results are amazing. I mean, you can just imagine what happened. Some of them got off to a good start, some of them got off to a bad start, and in the end, the basic findings of the result were that those that had an injury to parts of their brain that controlled their emotions, they bet on 16 out of the 20 occasions, even though they were getting 6-4 about an evens chance. Yet the people who had no impairment to the emotional elements of their brain only invested 12 out of 20 times, even though they were getting 6-4 about an evens chance. So I think that says a hell of a lot about how we get in our own way. And I totally empathise with the question that your client asked, because we do get in our own way. Why on earth would you invest 12 out of 20 times when you're getting 6-4 about an evens chance? The only possible conclusion is because we're starting to think about the run that we've had. And I started with a good bank. I could walk away with the $20 if I don't play now. But I've lost 5 in the first 5 tosses. I don't want to lose any more. I'll just close up shop. Well, it doesn't make sense. If you're getting 6-4 an evens chance, you should be betting on all 20, shouldn't you?
Oh, for sure. I've never heard of that case study, so I might look it up myself.
Yeah, I'm not sure the name of the study, but it's an interesting study, and I think the findings are something that we can all relate to. It's interesting. Another, some more statistics. I think I'm not sure exactly what they are, but it's something like in your punting life, you're going to spend more than 80% of your time with a bank lower than it's been at some point in the past, regardless of how successful you are. And I think there's some statistic that almost 50% of the time your bank's going to be at least 25% lower than it's been sometime in the past. So you've got to get used to these things. These are just normal things. I mean, income from a professional punting career is not going to come in a linear fashion. It's not going to come in a straight line. But you just have to have some resolve to that. And I think the most important thing is confidence. If you can build some confidence around what it is that is making you money, that will get you through those periods of negativity, for want of a better word, or some sort of drawdown on your bank. Does that answer your question, or is there...
It does, and there's a few follow-ups related to that. So these are all individual responses to a survey we sent out to our members, but it was, how do you stay confident when 3 or 4 punts go wrong? How do you handle a run of losses? Coping with losing runs? How does he deal with the psychological trauma of a long run of outs, losing odds on selections, discipline not to overbet? So, I mean, they're all on a similar theme, so I just thought I'd share that with you and see if there's anything else you wanted to mention about that and, you know, just the importance of mindset.
Well, I think in terms of handling a brutal long run, I can speak from experience. I recommend walking away. One of the things you can do is just put some space between you and what you're doing. Doesn't need to be 12 months, but you know, I think if you were having a bit of a bad run and you started to watch a spate of seconds or a spate of unlucky, you know, interferences or something like that, and you started to question yourself, and you could actually catch yourself starting to bring that negative talk into your mind, but I'll have a look at this, everything I back, you know, gets caught three wide or gets interfered with, or just take a break, just put some space between you and what you're doing for a week or two, clear your head and come back again with a fresh mindset. But when you do come back, get very clear about what it is you're going to do, what processes you're going to follow from a pre-race and a betting point of view, and still stick to those bets. And in regards to the over-betting elements of it, I think the most important thing to do there is have a list of bets and don't have any of those impromptu, spur-of-the-moment type of bets. I think they're probably the curse of every weekend warrior or every part-time punter.
Yeah, it depends, I think, for how the selections are being generated. In the for our members, if we've had a run of seconds and stuff, we encourage them just to, you know, dust themselves off and keep going, but, you know, not to bet more and not to bet less. I think it's different if you're actually doing the form yourself and a lot of it is your own, you know, gut instinct and experience, that can be swayed or, you know, negatively affected if you're having a bad run. But if you're following a proven approach, or if you're getting some third-party analysis done for you, we actually recommend that you stick it out, because the way variance works, I think people would be surprised that you can be doing a lot right but still losing.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I'd agree. If you're getting your information from a reputable sort of provider, yes, definitely try and stick with it. But if you have started to second-guess and pick and choose, then I think it's seriously time to consider what role you're playing in the outcome, and that might be when it's time to say, I'll just step away for a week or two.
Yeah.
You know, but yes, absolutely. If you're following them exactly the same and you're not picking and choosing, you're not saying, oh, I'm going to leave this one out, it's too short, or I'm not going to back that, it's too long. Yep, by all means, stick with it. It's definitely the plan.
All right, let's talk form. Nice, easy one to start with, and that is, what do you consider most important when assessing the form in a race? Nice broad one for you.
Yeah, very broad. For me, it's trying to identify what will be grossly undervalued or overlooked by the marketplace. And that can come from an analysis of sectionals, it can come from an analysis of rail positions, it can come from an analysis of where I thought the bias might be on the day. And then, of course, the important part of that is comparing it to what you're hearing in the marketplace, comparing it to what you think the mainstream opinions may be. A classic example there might be, Vince Accardi's IBRs, which I know Champion Picks have been a big supporter of over the time. You know, if something comes to town on a Saturday in a stakes race and it's a provincial Victorian maiden winner, it's going to be hard for a class weights ratings type of person to get it in. It might be hard too for a speed performance analyst to get it in into the market as well, depending on how the sections of that race were. But there could easily be things in the way Vince has looked at it, because he benchmarks them against every other horse rather than relative to class or rather than relative to anything else. So if, for argument's sake, that horse represented a good opportunity to me in a Saturday stakes race at only its second start in Melbourne, I would be comfortable that the reason that horse is overpriced is because it's undervalued by all traditional forms of ratings and pricing. And I'd be comfortable that it's because of the power of Vince's IBRs that you can back that horse on the premise that it's undervalued or overlooked by the marketplace. So it depends on what it is for you. For me, as I say, I find a lot of them from video replays, and I tend to look at form analysis from a horizontal rather than a vertical aspect. And what I'm getting at there is, when you pick up a form guide, you've basically got last run, second last run, third last run, fourth last run, et cetera, et cetera. And people want to get as many starts on a horse as they can. I understand that, but the key to successful punting is getting a longer horizontal line. So in other words, you can introduce a lot more variables about that particular run that'll give you more intelligence and insight into what might have happened on that day, rather than just finishing position, beaten margin, weight carried, in running positions, jockey, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And some of my biggest results have come from being able to have a broader, wider horizontal landscape in terms of how I look at each horse's run.
So if you're going deeper into each run, does that mean you don't go quite as far back as most people?
Yeah, I tend not to. Yep, I definitely weight recent runs a lot more significantly than obviously older runs, and I wouldn't necessarily go much further back than two preps. The exception to that is obviously if a horse is first up today, I might look at his last four or five first up runs if he's got a reasonable race history. And when I look at that, the sort of thing I will be looking for is a horse that might be, he's had five starts first up and never been placed. I'll go back and look at each of those first up runs, and along my horizontal line of variables, I'm trying to find something that is compelling enough for me to excuse or forgive or overlook any or all of those horses' first up runs. And that's pretty much how I'm doing things. And if I can find something that might have been unlucky at its last first up run and it finished fourth in good company, and its previous first up run it finished fourth again when it should have finished much closer, or its previous preparation it finished fifth when it was on a bog track and it didn't handle it, it's clearly a dry track horse. If I can find a compelling argument like that, then I'm getting, you know, then I'm getting excited about backing a horse that statistically has had five first up runs, never been placed. And if I can get what I think is a reasonable price about that horse, which almost certainly you will, you know it's because the market's probably looking at statistics rather than performance. And the wider you go with those horizontal factors, the more variables you can bring in, the more opportunity you've got of finding variables that might be, they might be different to how the marketplace is seeing things.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense. We've often said, you know, pretty much all the commonly available form and stats, that's baked into the cake. There's no real edge to be found there. It's the other stuff where you can find value. So we've tried to do that with our own class and speed ratings. And you said you do that with, you know, by digging very deeply into every run. Well, not every run, but more importantly, the recent runs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Next question was about jockeys. It says, do you have a list of jockeys that are questionable? So maybe not dishonest, but probably more importantly, unreliable.
Yeah, I'm glad you separate dishonest and unreliable, because the dishonest element is something I just push to one side. You'll go nuts trying to get to the bottom of who's honest and who's dishonest. And to be honest, you'll probably go broke first. I think the important thing is to, deal with the unreliability element. And I think we spoke a lot at the beginning of this call about confidence levels with punters. I think it's very important to understand confidence levels of jockeys as well. I think even very, very, like, top-class jockeys have runs. They come in and out of confidence. And I can imagine, you know, Nash Rawilla at Hong Kong at the moment, I think Nash is something like two winners from 109 rides in Hong Kong, and I just can't imagine that Nash is riding with the same confidence as he would have been in Sydney back in 2012 with those sorts of stats. So we all know he's an exceptionally good jockey, and we all know he's very capable at the top level. But how would you feel about backing him when he's two from 109 over there?
Very different to New South Wales, like you say. We had a question about the false rails as well and movable rails. So how does that impact your form analysis pre-race and post-race, where the rail position is?
It's definitely a factor. I think the most important thing there is just to be aware of how the track's played on previous occasions when the rail's been where it's going to be. So you have some sort of expectation from a pre-race perspective, but then most importantly, you need to be thinking on your feet on race day and make sure it's playing out the way that you expect it to play out, or if it's not, you've got to make the necessary adjustments. Probably the most recent example is Derby Day at Flemington this year. It's unfortunate, but it's true. It's one of those things that happen. I mean, anyone who was betting on Derby Day, as the day played out, it became more and more obvious you just did not want to be rail or on pace, and you had to make adjustments for it. I myself was a bit slow. I was too forgiving early. And then, you know, late, sort of middle of the day, it got tougher and tougher. And then ultimately, I felt it became unplayable towards the end, and you know, no surprise, Benaria wins the, I think it was the Meyer Classic on the day, is that what it was?
Yeah, which she came home pretty hard.
Yeah, well, she sat back and widest and then just came down the outside. I mean, I think that's probably the most favourable sort of run under those conditions. So, yes, you've got to consider it. You've got to have an expectation based on facts and history, but you certainly have to play it on the day. And when you play it, don't be too quick to condemn any scenario. If, for argument's sake, if you've got the first couple of races won by leaders, but they're all favourites, you have to make some compensation for that. You know, you can't have the first three races with leaders knocking up, but they're all 15s, 20s and 30s chances, and then say, oh, the fence is off. You have to be mindful of what the horses in various stages or various positions in the race actual expectations of winning were.
Okay, what about this one? I can't bring myself to back more than one horse in a race. If one doesn't stand out for value or it's a winning hope, I stay away. Is this the correct approach?
For me, I very rarely back just one horse in a race. So it's an individual thing. I just find some inherent comfort in backing more than one horse in a race. But I totally get how some people don't. I think I look at it this way. I look at them all as individual bets, though. So they all have to stand up in their own right. I'm certainly not looking at it from a point of view of saying, okay, well, I'm on the second pick, the third pick, and the fifth pick, and the cumulative percentage is this, so therefore I'm on a 9-4 chance, or I'm on an evens chance, or something like that. I want them all to be, all to represent value for their own individual reasons, and I'll just stake them accordingly in the same event.
Okay. Someone has said, I suspect that the profiles of winners are changing. In particular, longer priced horses are winning more frequently than in the past. What are your thoughts on this?
No.
That's something I can research, by the way, but just off the top of your head, do you think that's been more prevalent recently?
No, not sure. I've only been back since September, so no, I'm not sure on that. I would suggest, even if it is true, just to be careful of what time frame we're looking at, because of the nature of variance and results, if you look over a six-month period, it'll be different to what you'll get over a 12-month period, and different again to what you'll get over a longer 3-5 year period. So it might not have shifted statistics over a 3-5 year period, even though in the last 6 months that may well be valid.
Another one is, how successful a strategy is it to follow the money in a betting race? Favourites win a third of the time. How do you balance where the money is compared with your reading of the form?
Following money is great if you can get on before the money.
Which is kind of mutually exclusive.
Yeah, so I think following money is dangerous. That being said, one thing I do believe in is I think the era of static prices, I think the era of getting a set of market prices early in the morning and betting to those prices is gone. I think you definitely need to be a lot more aware these days of marketplace movements, and you need to have a dynamic element to your set of prices. And what I mean by that is, if you've got the favourite evens and the second favourite 5-2, if the favourite opens 5-4 on and it's into 6-4 on, and your 5-2 chance open threes and's out to 9-2, I don't think you can just bet that market like evens and 5-2 chances. I think you have to sit and say, right, what have I got in favour with what have I got in my favour with this 5-2 chance? Why am I getting 9-2 about my 5-2 chance? What could the market have possibly undervalued? And what is it overvaluing about the 5-4 to 6-4 on chance? And if you can come up with a definitive answer for that, then I think it's fine. Then I think you can play the race and you can play it confidently. If you can't, then you need to sit and say, right, I'm certainly not going to back the 5-4 to 6-4 on favourite, but I have to temper my enthusiasm about my second pick as well. So following money is dangerous. Backing market movers after the market move is going to put you in the poorhouse. But backing things that move in the opposite direction on the back of that market move is also going to cause you harm if you're not very confident about why that edge is there.
Now, we had a few questions about how to form a market and how to quickly frame your own market. You've mentioned before that you're more of a ticks and crosses, overs and unders kind of guy. Would there be any advice that you give someone that's looking to frame their own market to 95 or 100%?
Yeah, there's lots of little simple sort of methodologies you can do. I mean, they'll only give you a very, very, very simplistic sort of market, but by the same token, it'll give you some structure and it'll give you some understanding as to what you're working with. A simple one might be to give a points allocation to each of your horses, you know, from something like 10 down to 1, and then you price them on their percentage of a total number of points. So for argument's sake, if you've got your top-rated horse with 10 points and your total number of points for all your winning chances in the race is 20, then that horse's chances of winning the race are quite simply 10 divided by 20 or 50%. So you'd price that horse even money. And a horse that might have 1 point, you'd price at 5%, so you'd price him at $21. Very, very, very simplistic approach, but that is some way in which you can price horses. I think the more important thing, or perhaps the more profitable thing for people to pay attention to, is just market order. I think if you look at market order and assume if you use as a basic premise and a basic starting point that the market is pretty much right, and you work from there, then I think you've got a reasonable framework to start from. And by that I simply mean, when a market comes up on a Wednesday for a Saturday race meeting, put them in market order, go from the top to the bottom and see if you can pick some holes in them. If you find some obvious flaws in the credentials of the favourite and some obvious flaws in the credentials of the second favourite, then regardless of prices, if the third horse in the marketplace looks fairly solid to you, it's clearly going to be an overs proposition. I think if you follow that process from top to bottom, I think you get a clear idea without having to understand how to price them all. I think you get a clear understanding of where the opportunities may be in the race.
Okay, Nick, we'll leave it there for this week then. It's been a really interesting chat so far, but there's still plenty to talk about in terms of how to get a bet on, when to bet, reading a market, staking, money management, all of those things. So we'll talk about that next week.
Thanks for tuning in to Betting 360. Get more in-depth analysis, tips, and that betting edge by heading over to championpicks.com.au, where you'll find a full transcript of this episode. If you like the show, share us with a fellow punter or drop by iTunes to leave us your thoughts. Betting 360, punting from all angles.